I am absolutely honored to be here for this event, and congratulations to everyone that's receiving an award, but also the founders of the organization and all the board members that make this happen. It has such an impact. And Nadia, like-hearted, not like-minded. That is powerful and so true to the core of everything I believe in, and I think we all have to. Like-minded is never what we want. It's always like-hearted. So thank you for that comment. All right. What comes to mind when you look at this image? Blue marble. I get blue marble. Earth, planet. Some people say fragility, climate change. Any one of those we might think of. So let me tell you a story. About two years ago, I was at the Smithsonian, at the planetarium, with my 2.5-year-old daughter. And we were watching Journey to the Sun. And it started, much as many journeys to the sun will start. We are in a busy city street like LA or New York, and we do a big pan out, a zoom on our way to the sun, and on the way during that pan out, we pass an image that looks a lot like this. So it's completely dark, completely quiet, and she yells as loud as she possibly could, "Minions," which this seems pretty appropriate for here. Somebody might, but you know, you're thinking, where did that come from? But I'm like, yes, of course. Her experientially established prior of that image is coming from this one. And as far as she's ever experienced an image of the Earth for her at that time, she thinks of immediately of little yellow creatures, which is I'm fine with on a tolerance level. She says, we've got to keep it there. But what I really love about this is it points to the idea that is so critical to how we think about each other and our experience of content, is that we each have vastly different experiences of the exact same physical information in the world. And you know, it's not enough to just know what the physical information is. It's our underlying biology, our exposure, our priors, the information we've been exposed to in our environments, as well as our expectations. Our brain's constantly doing a malleable, a weighted calculation of information to decide how our individual experiences are going to be at any particular moment in time. And they're all different. You know, we evolve to be able to do the things we need to in our environment. Those things include communicate, find food, find a mate. In many cases, avoid being eaten. We might not have a tiger today, but that tiger has become like a flying Uber driver that we're trying to avoid in the city streets, right? And the pressures that we are involved in our environment, shape who we are. And they fundamentally mean they change our brain. If I've grown up in a village in Afghanistan, a town in the Midwest, a city like Kathmandu, a city like New York, each one of those has different environmental pressures that change my neuroplasticity, change the cell, what particular cells in my brain are responding to. If I think about, if you look at the upper right, you know, the upper left corner, the colors and contours of that environment are so vastly different. My brain is going to allocate more resources to allow me to have more specificity differentiating information in that environment. If I've grown up in an urban or a rural environment, it shapes who I am. You can look at the hearing profiles of people around the world and predict what city they live in. The noise, the information in our environments is shaping who we are at all times. If I'm in a city, that urbanization, I have to be able to respond. My situational awareness in the world is different than someone else's. These things are constantly changing, and they're different. But we all have different experiences of the world, yet we're not all my 2.5-year-old daughter, who's now 4, and doesn't associate the world entirely with minions. But we often keep those experiences to ourselves. We like to have what we call our poker face, right? We want to have control over what we share, when we share it, who we share it with, and how. Which, you know, is a good thing. But in many ways, technology is changing. And what I want to talk about today are scenarios. You know, we've moved past this idea that I think we have to think about a different future, and we get to write it. We should proactively write what we want that future to be like. But we've moved past, you know, machine learning algorithms that just detect whether I'm feigning a smile or a frown, to a state where an algorithm can know the authenticity of what I'm feeling, what my emotions are at a particular moment in time, tracking micro expressions, other types of information from my body. And where we're at today is we get to think about, there are some ways that this can be used in negative ways. That's not what I want to talk about today. What I want to talk about are the positive opportunities that we have to think about the future and the ways we can change and interact more intimately, more richly with the content and technologies that we interact with on a daily basis. Three big changes that are happening are, you know, one is what I call technology-targeted neuroplasticity. It's going to make us faster, recover more rapidly, hear more acutely, see more sharply, and think more effectively. Now, our brains are constantly malleable, and they're each different. If I play Call of Duty for 40 hours, I see the world differently than somebody else. You might not realize that, but you can look at visual contrast ratios of people that engage in like high-impact, you know, gaming that has lots of visual change, and they actually change how they see the world. That means every time we engage in rich environments, we walk out of them a different person. And we can start predicting that and predicting how technology will shape us and make us more effective. What I call empathetic technology is going to transform the relationship we have with each other and with the spaces where we work, train, heal, and live. And these are the spaces where we consume our content. One thing I want to say is sort of when I talk about empathetic technology, because a lot of things you've been talking about here, I think, you're thinking about emotion, avatars or, you know, capturing emotions from, you know, from individuals, but this is really closing the loop between the human and the technology, and that our technology is no longer one size fits all. We're getting to a place where technology can use our internal state, the success of information, success of how well technology is interfacing with me, as how it personalizes the experience to me, right? So empathetic technology is not about technology empathizing with me. It's about technology using my internal experiences as a decision driver in that algorithm for how it reacts. And that we aren't just defining how a technology objectively behaves or what, you know, what the end goal is. Instead, we're defining it based on how it actually interacts with the user. I'll give examples of this as we go on. So what's this have to do with content? Well, anybody know who this is? Tolstoy. Good. Yeah. You got it. So this is Leo Tolstoy. Leo Tolstoy wrote a lot of things. But one of the, he wrote this essay called What is Art? And trust me, I think a lot of artists probably can have a lot of difficulty with how he defines art. So don't worry if you do, because you're not alone. But I, you know, there were parts of it that I really resonated with me. So Tolstoy defines art by how well the intent of the creator is it only exists when the intent of the creator is experienced by the user on the other end. So it's all about creator's intent being realized. And for Tolstoy, which in, you know, I'm chief scientist at Dolby, and as far as I'm concerned, what we do is build tools that enable creators to touch, you know, to reach emotions of individuals and to create stories. And it's our responsibility to care about every point in the pathway that those stories are translated all the way to the end user and that they experience what they should be at the other end and that we've enabled that. But for Tolstoy, these were philosophical musings he's talking about. But today, between ubiquitous computing and the amalgamation of sensors in our environment paired with machine learning and AI, his musings we actually can realize at a different level, right? We can know what everyone is experiencing, and we can think about what closing that loop really means. So let me give you a few examples. Our breath, what we exhale, broadcasts a story of our emotions. There's the chemical composition of carbon dioxide, acetone, and isoprene change as we feel joy, suspense, fear, and all in ways, because non-overtly, just by the change in my heart rate, when my muscles tense, it affects the air that I'm breathing. We can actually measure that. So here's an example. This was a group that looked at, measured carbon dioxide levels of different audiences watching Hunger Games. And this is, you're looking at over in the corner, those are CO2 traces of five different audiences, different people, different times of day. And it's pretty clear, they're really similar, right? This is just in how we exhale. Like carbon dioxide, in fact, you know, it's heavier than air, so you can have sensors on the floor and pick that up very quickly and be able to actually measure this. You just have to account for the volume of the space. But you can actually predict where Katniss's dress catches on fire. I was gone this particular week, but my team worked, everyone's seen Free Solo here? Or anybody seen Free Solo with Alex Honnold climbing up? Yes. Right. Okay. I had a really funny experience with Alex. So I'm a rock climber, and so Alex Honnold is like this amazing, but a little bit crazy. How does he do this? You know? I met him at TED when I was speaking there, I couldn't go to his talk, but I was able to go to his rehearsal. And I love the fact that he was turned around watching the beginning of his TED talk, which starts with a scene from Free Solo where he is hanging off the cliff. And then he turned around to the audience, and I was one of the people at his rehearsal, and there were six of us there. And he was bug-eyed, and he goes, "Oh my gosh, I'm really nervous." Because if you haven't seen the film, he never gets nervous, that's for sure. But what's beautiful about this, so we worked with the filmmakers. They came in, and we had carbon dioxide in the floor, along the carbon dioxide sensors on the floor. I wasn't able to attend the showing. I came back and I could see the movie. I could see the film. I could see what the creators were trying to reach just in the CO2 trace of the audience. Right? This is the carbon dioxide and the galvanic skin response of the audience. And you can see where the climbs are. You can see where he abandons his climbs. And you can see even the love story just in the CO2 trace of the audience. Okay, this is just picking up the air that they're exhaling. It's not the amount of air, it's the concentration. All right, so I've been at Dolby for about 9 years in the technology space. But before then, I was actually research faculty in the med school at Johns Hopkins. And I come from a background where I'm a systems neuroscientist. And you know the problems we think about as systems neuroscientists and perception is the idea that we're always trying to understand the transfer function, how the world around us, how information from the world gets translated by this human body. You know, what are the transformations that happen? What information gets passed on? What are the coding errors that happen? What dimensionality reduction matters to actually achieve the perception that we want to get to at the other end? Right? But to me, that's no different than the program production pathway that we all work in, or at least many of us work in now. We're still caring about the same things. We want to take the intent of the creator and make sure that we, reduce coding errors, that we enable that experience to translate all the way to the end user. And it's these creators that we care about now. Because as far as I'm concerned, great artists, these creators, they understand the human brain, human perception, in ways that as scientists we spend so much time trying to figure out, but we haven't even caught up yet. That intuitive understanding of how to touch human emotion and human experience is so incredibly rich with artists and creators, and it's ultimately everything as scientists that we care about. So what I want to really hope that we start thinking about is, how do we get past just bits and pixels in terms of the information that we want to capture and translate? And really translate the code we care about translating from a creator to every endpoint that we consume content on, every environment we consume content on, every individual that consumes that content, that we've translated the code of the emotion, of the experience that was intended. Like that we have really translated what the creator's story was when someone's experiencing that, because we can know what people are experiencing on the other side. Now, I want to tell you a couple of stories. So what do I mean by creator's intent? I think a lot of people in this room think about that in many different levels. But here's a really simple example, but this is one I like. So everyone know this image? Monet's water lilies. He painted this towards the end of his career. And this is something I figured out, which I was really excited when I figured this out, because I had a hypothesis about it. If you've ever looked at water lilies with one eye, walking through museums with one eye is a really interesting thing to do. But with Monet, if you close one eye and look at this image right now, try it. Okay, so close an eye. You might notice that the lilies seem to pop out more. You get a stronger three-dimensional effect. Right. So I had a hypothesis that Monet actually couldn't make use of his stereoscopic vision for depth, integration of depth information. And in fact, he couldn't have. So there are different cues we use. We use binocular cues coming from two eyes, but we also use monocular cues, information coming from one eye to know, occlusion and shading. And in fact, Monet, if you go through his medical records, had very bad cataracts. And he also had one of the cataracts removed such that he couldn't have integrated information from both eyes. And that's entirely the time when he was painting water lilies. So when we talk about creator's intent, here's my question. When you look at this and you look through two eyes, are you actually seeing it as Monet intended? Or are you seeing it more as Monet would have intended when he, with one eye, right? I'm just trying to point out this idea that we experience information differently. And it is becoming one size fits all technology and experiences. We get to think, and we have to think, very differently in the future. Because it's not something, we can't, it's not good enough to just let it be. So three ways, control, insight, and creation, are the three things that matter to get us to this next level. And when I say control, we need to understand the perceptual experience, how the physical world goes through the human perceptual body and build models that predict that. Example of control, take a look. Watch the light in the corner, okay? Well, one moment. Ultimately, what we're trying to get to when we think about control is we want to predict and optimize perception. We want to establish efficient dimensionality reduction. And we want to scale and optimize our experiences. Those are the three things that really matter to us. But here's an example. I want you to look up at the sunshine in the corner, okay? And watch the bubbles. And if you're doing that, is everyone doing that? All right. So you probably noticed that the bubbles float up the screen. And they seem to fly off the screen. Does everyone see them going off at a sort of oblique angle? Flying off? All right, now shift your gaze to where the bubbles are. Okay? All right, so you can go back and forth. You'll notice a difference. Now. All right, so what's happening here? So, yeah, no, I built this very specifically to but it'll make you not want to get in an airplane, right? For some reason, No, but this happens all the time in the world. But something that's what's happening here, though, is two things. One, just underlying this is you have two different types of motion. You have a horizontal grating across the bubbles, and then that's paired with the visual vertical motion. When your gaze is focused on the bubbles, your brain can take those apart, and you experience each of the motion as they are. But when your gaze is focused on the light, and those bubbles fall in your periphery, your brain integrates that information, and you experience some sort of something different, the experience of the oblique trajectory. And I'll tell you, each of us is slightly different in how we integrate that information. So we're each having a slightly different experience, right? But it's just as real. This is what your brain does. Things in your periphery, we process color, we process change, we process motion all differently, depending on where our gaze is directed. Why is this important? So as a developer, I'm in a really bad place if I don't know where you're looking, right? There's all sorts of things I can do if I just know one thing, and that's where your eye is directed, right? Knowing that one piece of information gives me huge capacity to optimize my coding, to create a better experience, to direct what you feel, everything. And you know what I love here is 15 years ago, pupil trackers, things to know where someone's gaze was directed, cost me $15,000, $20,000, $30,000 in my lab. Today, those are dollars and soon pennies in every pair of smart glasses. The type of information to close the human loop and optimize this is changing. So we need to have control and predictive models, but we want to gain insight to what someone is experiencing. And that's when it gets really interesting. So as humans, we like to think that we have a lot of control over the signatures we share. But in fact, we haven't changed as humans, but the ubiquity of sensors in our environments, in the places where we consume content, in our homes, is changing and going to change even more because of the potential benefits. Now, for some creatures, this is the norm, and we see how their bodies react, how their biology reacts to the world around them all the time. As humans, I say we do the same thing, and I'll show you some examples. But here's an example of what I mean with another species. So this is a spider in my garden. Now, I'm actually a violinist. I'm not a singer, but bear with me because some of you, I'm sure, are real singers. And just listen. So my daughter actually does classify spiders now as the kind we don't touch and the kind mommy sings to. So she asked me last week to sing to a spider in the car because she was scared of it. I was like, okay, I'm sure it's going to help. But it's, you know, it actually turns out some spiders tune their webs to resonate like violins. And in this case, as my frequency went higher and the intensity of my harmonics and the change in loudness, the spider reacted to me as if I were a predator, potentially. A bird echolocating back and bat, and it told me to bug off. Made sense. But biology is telling us what the inner world is doing for that spider. We see it. It's pretty cool. It's pretty beautiful. Do we do the same thing as humans? Well, I'd say we do. Now, here's an example. I wanted you to try to understand the two talkers that you're about to see. Okay? Your eye changes. From the diameter of your pupil, your autonomic nervous system drives your pupil to dilate or contract for multiple different reasons, right? Now, it can dilate for reasons I think we're all aware of, such as changes in our lighting conditions, right? But it also dilates or contracts based on changes in your engagement and your mental effort. And that's where things start to get really interesting and quite powerful. So try to understand the two talkers, and if you are, I promise your pupil's doing the same thing as the subject in our labs.
Intelligent technology depends on personal data. Intelligent technology depends on personal data. Intelligent technology depends on personal data. Intelligent technology depends on personal data.
So your pupil's dilating when you are engaged in content. It's dilating when your brain's having to work harder to solve a problem. Now, in that case, your brain's trying to hear two different talkers, but that happens all the time. I promise I can create that same experience by changing, in this case, we removed one talker. We can change the signal-to-noise ratio, make one talker louder, create the same experience. We can spatialize them. Same thing. Spatializing two talkers creates a release for masking. You can also drive and enhance an experience and increase the capacity for people to be more effective. What I love about this is so informative for the potential for new technologies to know, even if I'm watching content and I've been staring at subtitles, that has broken my experience, no question about that. But if instead a device in my ear catches that, you know, because I can measure cognitive load in someone's ear, knows that I'm under a situation of increased cognitive load, plus there's a microphone to know what I'm doing, because that suddenly disambiguates those three different things that could be causing my pupil to dilate or contract, and automatically changes the signal-to-noise ratio of dialogue. Now I'm in a much better place where I'm having a much richer emotional experience with the content that's been created for me. We can track neural responses and look at P300 responses. These things tell us, can understand how people associate adjectives with experiences that are very rich. You can pick up neural signatures that show whether what people most associate with what they happen to be seeing at a particular moment in time. And those ways of tracking that technology are moving into people's ears. Now, that type of understanding, the human subconscious, has been used by a lot of companies. It's been used and it's been able to show increased retention, subscription retentions, higher brand favorability. When people have higher emotional responses with content, they have a better experience. They have a better representation and favorability of everything that goes with that. Emotion is a powerful thing, and it is what people want to feel. Now, anybody guess what this trace is? I'll tell you, they're watching some content. Yeah. I'm not sure if it'd be quite. All right, so close. They're watching football, soccer match. The person watching this is actually, that was a not particularly a football or soccer fan. So it's not an emotional, they're not emotionally engaged. But what's beautiful about this is galvanic skin response. So this is just measuring, looking at the conductance changes in my skin. And you're able to perfectly predict everywhere there was a penalty kick. Right? That human anticipation, you can't turn it off. You know, and we want to feel that when we have experiences of content, right? That is the most powerful thing. Wait, I think I... When we were developing Dolby Vision, and this is a story I love telling, we were working with research-grade devices. This is about 9 years ago, shortly after I joined Dolby. And they let us get up to 20,000 candelas per square meter. We had not defined what Dolby Vision would be in terms of the specifications and standards and targets. But I was watching some content that was fire content. I had a dancer, a fire dancer, and he had a whip of flame. And he whipped it on the, you know, like on the screen. It wasn't 3D, it didn't pop out or anything like that. But I felt my body react to it. My immediate reaction was, okay, there's this highly specular region on the screen. The screen must be giving off heat. You know, because you can't ask people, does this happen to you too? Because you feel kind of crazy, right? But also, introspection's a bad thing. You want to know objectively what are people experiencing. That's powerful. And how does that actually translate to the emotions that they, you know, ascribe to those experiences? So, in fact, I got out of the thermal image camera, tracked the screen, perfectly constant. But we could show regions of people's cheeks changing in response to the luminance of the flame. So content-specific reactions where their bodies were engaging with this display content as if it were real. So just based on my knowledge that it was fire, fire's hot, and the luminance reaching my retina, my body was reacting and saying, basically going, okay, I've never experienced fire that wasn't real, that was that bright. And so I'm going to react to it as I would in nature, authentically. This was powerful because this set the stage for how we want to create immersive experiences, which are engaging our bodies as authentically as possible when we need them to. And we're able to track in the thermal responses, we can track engagement and stress, because your body's very reactive. We dynamically are, you know, radiating our stories. Our voice, I think, how many people are familiar with how much your voice gives away about your mental and physical wellness? Yeah, it's pretty powerful. In the last 10 years, you know, I think everyone is familiar with voice, for, you know, the voice as an assistant, you know, driving our devices. But the power as a phenotype, our voice, our breath, will capture are huge. It's not what you say, it's how you say it. The dynamics, the statistical dynamics paired with machine learning of information in the trajectories of how you speak, the timing of different utterances can predict Alzheimer's, sometimes 10 years before, because there are changes that show up in your linguistic structure that are independent of what you say and much more predictive, because now we have this unprecedented time of understanding longitudinal data about an individual. And that's really powerful for thinking about the experiences of an individual. Okay, and one of the last ones I have is even interpersonal relationships. Psychologists have actually used time series of how people are, couples, been able to predict the success or cessation of couples just based on how they speak to each other with machine learning models, not what they say. They're not looking at all at what they say, just how they say it. And I think we all know that's true, right? All right, so this is one of my favorite stories. Everything I've been talking about is how do we understand and use these tools that exist that are amalgamated to get a richer insight to the individual, to us, to personalize content, to improve the experiences we have. But ultimately, we're social. We're social creatures, and the experiences we create in the cinema and such are some of the most noble and powerful places to create, where to touch human emotion. And one of the things that So this is looking at that, is how do we actually interact together? One of the species I spent a lot of time working with in my past is common marmoset. Marmoset's a primate that lives in the Amazon in Brazil, but in dense foliage. They live in the trees. But there's this problem. They're really social. Their happiness, their well-being, how successful they are depends on how successfully they interact with other marmosets. And they can't see each other, though, because they're in the trees. So what happens? If you go to Asia and you interact with monkeys, they're like old world monkeys, they're very visual. They make lots of facial gestures. These guys don't. Instead, they are very stoic and then have these beautiful vocalizations like birdsong. But they also have these pheromonal systems that are amazing. The dominant female of a colony secretes pheromones that causes, just based on her mental state, affects the biology of all the other females in her colony. You can take a female out, have her in the same proximity, but with a new role in her colony, and her biology will completely change and affect other females. It's very powerful. Now, one of the things that I think is so powerful here is, look, these guys, I'm not talking about human pheromones, but I am talking about the non-overt signatures that we exchange and interact with as social creatures when we consume content and interact in the cinema and everywhere else. So what I want to show is some of the data that we've recently collected on what is the power of the shared experience. Now, before I wrap up, I want us all, courtesy of Sony, we're going to watch this clip from Baby Driver, okay? Has everyone seen Baby Driver? Yeah, thank you. great film. Very powerful.
You did good, kid.
But you took something away from me that I love. You know I gotta do the same.
I really wish you could hear her scream.
All right. That's a really powerful scene, in context especially. Now, what we've been able to do is look at these emotional scenes, some of the scenes from this film as well as others, when people are watching them by themselves, when people are watching that same clip and other clips in proximity, with no overt interactions, no screaming, no grabbing, no none of those things that we know affect who we are and affect our emotions. And what we're looking at here are just the neural, how our brains, we're measuring EEG, so electroencephalograms, and galvanic skin response and other biometrics. And what we're able to see is that we synchronize. Our neural signatures, we feel things together when we are in spaces together. It's hugely powerful. The moments where baby gets, where she screams, that's one example. Another is here. The red is the coherence metric of individuals when they're in the same room. And the blue is when they're not in the same room. And we've done this in a really controlled space, controlled way. But this is at the core of being human and the power of the experiences that are created and why the cinema will always be absolutely relevant to human connection. And these particular signatures actually increase. They increase when you're more immersed in a high dynamic range content, more immersive audio environments. They just escalate the neural coherence that's being exchanged between humans in the same proximal experiences. This has impact for the cinema. It has impact for why music experiences are so relevant as well, live shows. And it has even impact on healthcare and how we put people together with caregivers. But it is really at the core of being human and interacting with powerful emotional experiences. So with that, I will leave you to say, we have new tools. We have new tools to give to the creators. We have new tools to understand the impact of storytelling from the creators. And we can write that future in a really positive way to enhance and engage with the opportunity that happens in the cinematic viewing experience. Because I'd say it is today one of the most noble places to actually build memories of human emotion anywhere in the world. And the things we see in our labs is that is a very significant objective experience that leaves very impactful imprints on the human body. So thank you.
Thank you, Poppy. Poppy Crum, ladies and gentlemen. Amazing. Thank you so much. That was so wonderful.